And welcome back to Coast with our very special guest, Billy Carson. I'm going to tell you all about Billy in a moment. And, of course, we'll be talking about the Great Flood, some UFOs, the Great Pyramids, and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you. Billy Carson is the founder of ForbiddenKnowledge.com. He is also an avid blogger, social media manager, contributor for the Huffington Post. Billy combined forces with top anomaly hunters in the world to form the United Family of Anomaly Hunters. Their mission is to provide evidence of past and present life on Earth and other celestial bodies inside our own solar system. Hey, Billy, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back, George. Thanks for having me on here.
Oh, my pleasure. How have you been? What's new with you?
I'm fantastic, man. So many new things and exciting things going on since the last time that I saw you and was on your show. First and foremost, you know, I own a conscious record label and an album that we put out a month and a half ago made Billboard. It's been on Billboard now for almost 5 weeks, which is amazing.
Good for you.
Excited about that. Yeah. My book, The Compendium of the Emerald Tablets, was just released, and it's selling like crazy, and a lot of people are really giving me a lot of good feedback about it. I can barely keep the printing going on how fast people print these books and get them out.
You have looked at different things on this planet now for so many years. What have you found, Billy, to be the most fascinating for you?
To me, the most fascinating, and I just can't stop talking about this. Some people may have heard me say this before, but the fact that when I went to the USGS.gov website, which our tax dollars paid for, and accessed the radar images of Venus, because we fully mapped the entire planet of Venus through radar imaging, and just seeing the anomalies that are on the planet Venus, because they should not exist according to what we've been told about the barometric pressure and the heat and all the things that they've told us over all the many, many years. There shouldn't be anything that can withstand the surface. However, when I dug a little deeper, I discovered that Russia had sent 14 missions to Venus, the Venera missions, and several of them landed successfully using parachutes, George, parachutes that were supposed to, I mean, I don't know how they can withstand those temperatures. They should build structures out of those type of materials if they can withstand those heat, and as well as the pressure should never have even allowed the probes to land. Not only did they land, but they also took pictures and transmitted photos back. And one of the most amazing things from the Venera missions is that they transmitted back an image of something moving on the ground that appeared to be a life form of some sort. This is well documented. It's on Wikipedia. Anybody can look it up just by typing in Venera missions, Russia, Venus. They'll find the pictures. They'll find the videos of the actual object from the Russian Space Agency. And it clearly looks like some type of a crab that's moving around on the ground. So it's one of the most amazing things that I've ever discovered. Life potentially on Venus with structures, buildings, and from this Russia Space Agency image and video, which they stand by, an object moving on the ground.
And Billy, you know, we've heard so many strange stories about Venus. Frank Stranges, who wrote books about Valiant Thor, claimed that he came from Venus many, many years ago. There's strange stories, but people keep talking about Venus.
I know, Stranger at the Pentagon. I mean, it's an amazing book that I read years before I looked into Venus, and I was scratching my head going, man, that sounds like a really spaced out concept, because again, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, raining molten iron, pressures that would crush anything, nothing can survive. The temperatures, you know, exceeding 500 and 600 degrees and so forth and so on. Now, all of a sudden, you look at the new data on Venus, and here we go. Now they're saying there's potentially life in the clouds of Venus, that they're seeing what they consider now to be algae bloom. This is on the official NASA website now. It's a real press release. They see what they believe may be algae blooms, and they want to send a probe to the upper atmosphere of Venus to basically scrape that particular what they think is biomaterial and do a test on it in a science lab on board that probe and transmit it back to Earth. Now, they're also saying that they've now discovered that there's organic material on Venus. You know, so little by little, here comes the drip-by-drip disclosure on Venus as they gear up to spend trillions of dollars to go explore this planet, which to me is probably more Earth-like than we even know.
Do you, when you do your work, have you ever jumped into the Bible to compare it to those stories with what science is telling us today, like the Great Flood?
Yes, all the time, all the time. You see, a lot of people discount the Bible as complete foolery, but you can't do that because even though there's a lot of information in the Bible that has been altered and changed, there's a lot of good content in there too that has been copied from even older ancient texts, which you can then kind of put together the pieces of the puzzle and find out what the ancient history was, you know, was all about and what was really kind of what the theme was back then. Going into the theme of the flood story, the Bible is fairly new for all intents and purposes. It was written between 100 to 800 AD. So it's really just copied material, copied information. The people that are being talked about in the Bible were long gone and deceased by the time the Bible was written. However, the information that they copied, for example, the flood story, no matter what civilization you go to around the entire planet, you will get a flood story. And of course, it's in the Bible. But then when you go from the Bible, most people think that's the oldest book that exists. But when you start going into Sumerian tablets, you discover that there was a great flood. When you go into the Enuma Elish and the seven tablets of creation that was discovered. When you go into the Atraasis epic, again from Sumeria, and when you go to the Sumerian Kings List, which is in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, England, again, you discover that kingship was handed down from these advanced beings to human or half-human, half-advanced, half-Anunnaki, half-human beings after a flood. So the more you look, you just discover, and then now also geologists have found geological evidence of this flood, not only in ice cores, but also in digs, and mines all over the planet. They can see the layer. The layer exists, not only for one flood, but maybe even potentially two floods that potentially covered the Earth or most of the Earth. So that's pretty amazing. Now, go ahead.
And, well, we don't know how the floods were caused. It could have been a tsunami from an asteroid, right?
Could have been a tsunami from an asteroid. It could have been a pole shift of the crust of the planet. Excuse me. So the crust of the planet could slip. The tectonic plates can actually slip from time to time, which potentially is what happened to Antarctica, how Antarctica moved into the position that it is right now. And that would definitely cause a global flood, because when you look at the evidence of the animals that are being dug out of the ice, now that the ice is melting in Antarctica, they typically have undigested food in their bellies, which means that they were flash frozen, which again also means that that particular continent or that region moved into that position in an extremely fast amount of time, and then they froze there. So it was in a more tolerable climate at once before it moved to that position. So that to me tells me that there was a pole shift of the crust of the planet at some point that maybe shifted us maybe 20 to 30 degrees and moved it into that location. That would have caused a great flood easily.
Billy Carson with us, and we're talking about anomalies that occurred on planet Earth many, many years ago. You've also looked at evidence for the Hall of Records. Edgar Cayce claims that they were in three spots around this planet. One would be around the Bimini area, another one would be by the base of the Sphinx, and then one would be in Central America somewhere. What do you think?
I think he was pretty close, man. I mean, when I look into the Emerald Tablets, which is the reason why I did this book, The Compendium of the Emerald Tablets, because I really want to break down the knowledge and wisdom, because it ties into so many things like Edgar Cayce, the Bible, the Sumerian Tablets. The Emerald Tablets predates all of this. They go back over 36,000 years. And one thing Thoth, the Atlantean priest king, talks about in the Emerald Tablets is the fact that there's a Hall of Records with that he hid all the information that would help guide us into like the next golden age and help man ascend to a higher level of knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. And according to him, he hid these records not only in Giza, but some of the people that he worked with took these records around the planet. So what Edgar Cayce is saying, maybe he read the Emerald Tablets or maybe he just had some phenomenal insight. But recently they just did a nuance scan of the Great Pyramid. And so in one of the chambers, Thoth claims to have left some important records and documents. Well, they just did a recent nuance scan and discovered a hidden chamber directly above the Grand Gallery in the Great Pyramid. So all of a sudden, here's one location. Then he talks about hiding records in his regeneration chamber. in the halls of Amenti, which are directly beneath the Great Pyramid, but very, very deep in the earth. Now, again, recently, they discover hundreds of chambers and rooms about a mile down beneath the Great Pyramid. So, again, ancient content backing up modern the science, you know, modern discoveries. And then, again, it talks about records being taken from Egypt all the way over to Mesoamerica. Like Edgar Cayce says, that's where they discovered the Emerald Tablets, over there near the Pyramid of the Sun in a tunnel.
And so, Billy, explain to us, explain to everybody what the Emerald Tablets are.
The Emerald Tablets are basically a writing that was done by Thoth the Atlantean himself, T-H-O-T-H. He didn't use a scribe. Back then, a lot of kings and rulers used scribes, but he claims to have written these himself. And these documents that he wrote, he basically etched them into these emerald type of tablets and looped them together with hoops and little chains. And supposedly, the tablets themselves, the atomic structure is supposedly fixed where they can't be corroded or changed over time. But either way, he wrote these tablets, and basically they go into a scenario of talking about the Great Flood, building the Pyramid of Giza. It talks about encountering human beings on this planet. The very first verse inside the Emerald Tablet, Thoth is told he's told to, by his dad, to go to the land of Chem. Now, the land of Chem is ancient Egypt. Before it was called Egypt, it was called Chem. That's where we get chemistry and alchemy from. Uh-huh. He's told, after the water resides, go to the land of Chem and raise the people there, the barbarians, back to a high level of civilization. So right away, they're talking about the water. The water's receding, people coming out of caves. It talks about going to find these barbarians. And when he lands his ship, and you have to say it lands because he says that he's flying over the land, and he looks down and sees an ancient temple and the barbarians, and he descends from the sky down to the ground with his crew. So right there, that's evidence of a UFO, something that's flying, something that flies. And then when he opens the door to the ship, the barbarians come to attack him, and he raises his staff and sends out a ray of vibration, stopping them still as stone in the mountain. So he has some type of an ancient stun gun or high-tech stun gun in ancient times, I should say, that stops these people and halts them until he can calm them down and explain what he's there for, which he then begins to show them his advanced technology, some of his trinkets and so forth. And the people begin to grovel at his feet, call him a god. He says, no, I'm not a god. You know, sit down, let's talk about peace. Let's talk about building this area. I mean, it's just an amazing story. So then it goes into talking about raising man's consciousness, cycles of cyclical cycles of where mankind rises and falls mentally, and consciously, and also technologically. And he also talks about traveling to other planets and watching men rise and fall as they try to seek the light. So it's a real amazing, amazing book.
When you looked at what's been going on this planet since the beginning of time, what was that one thing, Billy, that just struck out for you that was the strangest?
The strangest thing for me, I would have to say, is the fact that there were people, according to these ancient tablets, and I'm talking about the Enuma Elish, which, you know, really ancient Sumerian tablets that are in museums that anybody could look up, that there were people on this planet that did not claim to be humans before we were here. You know, so it's about 450,000 years ago, they're claiming that they were here mining this planet for resources. This doesn't come from Zachariah Sitchin or any other authors. This comes directly, what I'm saying, directly from the tablets that they used in their own books. But these tablets predate the age. They were deciphered before Sitchin and some of these other people were even born.
Right.
That's all this goes back to the 1800s. But I
would guess, so that you would agree that Sitchin, his work, even though it may have come later, was probably spot on?
I've done the research myself. Now, I've read the tablets myself, thanks to the UCLA Cuneiform Digital Library, and I've come to the same conclusion as Sitchin. Now, there's a couple of variances here and there, you know, between myself and some of the other authors, but the overall underwriting theme seems to be the same. People came here from another planet, maybe even another solar system, and mined this planet for resources. They got into a fight within themselves. At some point, they decided to create a worker slave. They didn't want to go with the robotic AI because they didn't want to they didn't want to get taken over, and which is where we need to stop with what we're doing right now. But then they created a biological robot, a biological slave, which would be the humanoid. They didn't create. Create is the wrong word to use. They actually genetically modified an existing hominid already on this planet to bring it to a certain level of consciousness, but at the same time, disconnect it from nature. That's where your junk DNA comes in. This is where the version of the human that we are now, the Homo sapien, is completely disconnected from nature. We no longer use the magnetite in our brains to navigate the planet. We're no longer in sync with the Schumann resonance like we used to be. And we've completely became like a virus on top of the surface of this planet, only because we've been disconnected. And that's what they call junk DNA. That was all disconnected stuff that they did. But what they did do was they put a gene in for worship, which has been scientifically proven. They did a chromosome number two fusion, telomere to telomere fusion, to shorten our lifespans, and basically put us in a position to where we have to be humble to them and follow their commands.
And do you think that this cross that they did, that whatever creature was on the planet at the time, was it ape-like? What do you think it was?
I think it was most likely, I don't think it was Neanderthal. I think it was pre-Neanderthal. I believe that it was probably a human being that was in a fallen state. See, one of my theories is, after reading the Enuma Elish, I discovered that there was a planet called Tiamat, which was just outside of the orbit of where Mars is now. Mars was actually a moon of this Tiamat water world, which is 4 to 6 times larger than Earth, but also had solid ground and potentially intelligent life. Now, when this planet exploded in an ancient battle, which you can perceive it as an ancient battle when you read it, or a collision of planets, depending on how you want to take it in. But when it did that, it broke up into pieces and chunks. Now, a giant chunk of this Tiamat swung down into the position where we are now and became the Earth as it recoalesced. And so you have a situation there. This goes back billions of years, where we could have already brought all the water, everything we needed here, material to start life, and then all of a sudden we ascend back to a certain high level of civilization on this planet. However, what happens? We fall again through the yuga cycle. Something happens, whether it's a geological disaster, whether it's war, but we fall again. And I believe that the Anunnaki arrived here at a time where human beings were most likely in a fallen state, almost cavemen again. Not because we evolved to be cavemen, but because we de-evolved from a higher level in more ancient times. And they took advantage of that.
Is there something to do with the devil or anything with that kind of ancient research?
Well, when you look into the tablets, you discover that there were two brothers, Enki and Enlil. And they go back. They're well known even in the Jewish online library. They're those names, Marduk and Enlil and Enki, they're in all the documentation that predates the Bible. Now, this Enlil was a brutal ruler over the planet. Enki, who was actually his brother, the planet Earth is actually named after Enki. His name was Ea, which was the capital E, capital A, last name or first initial, whatever you call it, name, Enki. Ki means Earth. So over time, it became Ea, Earth, Earth with the key. But he should have ruled the planet, but for whatever reason, he did something and his father put Enlil in charge instead of him. Enki was the geneticist, master geneticist. So Enlil was brutal. He would do all the things that we're seeing right now. He would put out chemtrails. In other words, he would actually drop these chemicals on crops of humans when they got.
Jeez, he would destroy people. Billy, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Billy Carson with us as we're talking about the wonders of this planet, and we'll get to your calls as well in our final half hour here. What fascinates you of all the structures that you've studied, Billy? Which one really, really gets you?
Well, I have to go back to the one that I saw on Venus. That it looks like an identical copy, not identical, but very close to the Burj Khalif out of Dubai on Earth. Well, there's a region there that has these structures. It's like a mini city where you can actually see ports and canals and lakes and then these structures that appear to be coming up off of the surface, forming this little city. These are all like high-rise type buildings. the thing that was most amazing, the reason why I say it's the most amazing is because I've seen structures in all over the solar system. But the thing that makes this one more amazing is the fact that these structures don't appear to be dilapidated or destroyed or run over by floods or exploded like a lot of the other places. Like when you look at Mars, you see a lot of structures that are completely broken down, and it's hard to even make out what they are. You just have to look for geometric patterns and 90-degree angles. But on this particular image that I've discovered on Venus, which was on your show actually one time, the buildings appear to be intact.
Now, with everything that you've studied, the ancients, when they put together these structures, how did they possess the knowledge to do that? I was talking to our previous guest about that, and he was zapped off. How did they, like the pyramids, how do they build these things?
Well, the most amazing thing about these ancient structures is the fact that they're built by people that are probably about a million years ahead of us, okay? And so when you take that into consideration, look at us where we are now, where we've come in just 100 years technologically, and let's just even look at what released technology has been to the general population of Earth. We don't even know what they're hiding behind closed doors. They're probably about 300 years ahead of us technologically right now, them being the military-industrial complex. So now multiply that by a million years and look at what you have. You have beings that have now completely mastered the ether of space-time. In other words, what appears to be empty space, dark matter, dark energy, all the things that Nikola Tesla talked about that are the unseen, that when you merge the unseen with the seen, you'll basically understand the keys of the universe, 369. All of these things, they've already mastered. So in the Emerald Tablets, Thoth talks about being able to create matter with frequencies. In other words, he was able to actually create structures to build one of his temples using frequencies and light and turning that into matter. Now you look at that in your mind, you go, oh man, that sounds too crazy. But now just look in my book, I just published an article, scientific journal, that scientists have now, for the first time, just a few months ago, created matter out of the ether using light and frequencies. So they must have read the book or they must have read the Emerald Tablets, because now they're doing the same exact thing. They're just rediscovering what the ancients already knew, how to manipulate space-time, and everything is based on frequency and vibration. And when you understand how frequency and vibration interact with what we consider to be empty space, which is really an illusion, then you have the ability to create and make anything you want from almost anything, because we're living in a light matrix, and this new scientific experiment proves it.
Billy, when we talk about fallen angels from the Bible, what do you think happened?
Well, the fallen angels are really fallen aliens, in my personal opinion. And it goes back to a story in the Enuma Elish where these Ijiji working class Anunnaki people were mining on Mars, and their conditions on Mars were already rough. Not as rough as they are now, but rough, very dry, arid place. They had no women up there. They were being worked as if they were slaves, even though they weren't truly slaves. And they got set up and had a revolt. And they came down. They fell down or came down to Earth, however you want to look at it or call it, encircled Enlil and Enki's encampment and said that we're going to go to war. Unless we get relief or we find a solution here, we're going to have a battle. We're going to literally have a battle. And that's when they decided to genetically modify the existing hominid on this planet to create a worker slave, or the statement was made to that effect, let's work on that and see if we can make it happen, was done. And then these Ijiji Anunnaki people took women with them and wifed them and took some of them back to Mars with them and to other regions of the planet that they were working and laboring on here on Earth as well. And that's where you have the account in Genesis where the sons of God mated with the daughters of men. And that's where that information comes from. It came from this ancient epic of these Ijiji working class people getting fed up and revolting against the rulers.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Pat in Minneapolis, Minnesota to get things started. Hi, Pat.
Hi, two quick ones.
Sure.
My sister leans toward the idea that the stones of the pyramids were poured and not cut. And that would explain why you can't fit a piece of paper between them to this day. And now that you're talking about the offspring of in Genesis, the Nephilim, my dad thinks that Hercules was one of those because the gods, so-called gods of Mount Olympus in Greece, may have been a group of those beings. And I noticed that the male gods could reproduce with human women, but when Venus was in love with Adonis, they didn't reproduce. So I think that's one of those things where there's a difference in reproduction by gender. But the other thing I noticed recently is I always wondered, why did God cut people back from hundreds of years of life to 120? Why not 100 years or 150 years? I could never, it just didn't make sense to me. Until now, a couple years ago, the scientists found out that the lifespan of the telomeres on the ends of our DNA last 120 years.
Billy, what do you think?
That's correct. Yeah, well, I'll start with the last question first. You're absolutely right about that. Scientific study was done at Harvard University. I've actually worked on shows and did articles about this where they discovered that the that there was an actual forced transmutation of chromosome number 2. In other words, somebody went in millions of years ago, maybe hundreds of thousands, whatever, in the past, and literally took this chromosome out and capped it. And when you look into the Bible, you look at the Tower of Babel incident in the Old Testament, you discover that Yahweh, who's actually Enlil, the evil one, he comes back and sees that human beings are building this tower to the heavens. Some people, you know, consider it to be, may have been a spaceport. Some people say it was just a tall tower, or they were mimicking something that they saw the Anunnaki building back in those ancient times. It could have been a cargo cult type of a setup. But however, he didn't like this because he came to the realization that whatever human beings can set their mind to do, they can accomplish it, and which means they can be potential rivals against them, the quote-unquote gods themselves, especially since they outnumber them by millions of people. So what did he do? Again, proving that he's not the creator of the universe, all full of love, he destroys this Tower of Babel. Not only does he destroy it, but he actually makes a statement in the Sumerian text and also in the biblical Bible, which copied it, that my seed shall not abide in man forever. His years shall be 120. This is an ancient account of a genetic mutation that was ordered by the ruler of the planet named Enlil. And now in modern times, we discover that this genetic mutation has taken place and that mankind's lifespan is only 120 years. However, they have discovered how to how to stop the shortening of the telomeres in mice and get them to live up to 3 times as long as they normally would. So the technology is out there now where we can actually shorten these telomeres. Whether the mainstream or the general population will ever see it, we don't know. Maybe sometime in the future they'll try to sell us time, like the movie that came out with Justin Timberlake. So we'll have to see what happens.
Tom, you know, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah,
we've got a text. Go ahead. Okay, I keep stepping on you. Go ahead.
That's okay. No problem, George, man. You can step off, man. I appreciate you. the second question that you asked was in reference to what was that again?
It was, it was in reference to Enki.
Oh, Enki and Enlil, yeah. Enki was the evil one. He was the satanic one. Basically, Enki had kind of twisted it and said that, Enlil was the evil one. I apologize. Enlil was the evil one. He kind of twisted it and said that Enki was the evil one.
They were brothers, though, right?
They were brothers, right. But he despised Enki because Enki would always go against his wishes, and especially when it came to the genetic modification of humans, he went in and he actually, the question was about how come we don't live that long anymore. He actually went in and genetically modified the humanoid, but not only to make him a worker slave, but he gave us a little bit too much of the juice, so to speak. In other words, he gave us the ability to rise to a higher level of consciousness, not only rise, but maybe even potentially outdo the Anunnaki themselves. And when this was discovered, it was scorned upon. They wanted to outcast him and everything else. Not only did he do that, but he also took on a human wife or started mating with humans, and that took it to a whole nother level, you know, so he was even banned from going back to his home planet. But, you know, so this is kind of where Enlil started twisting and saying he was Satan and he was evil, but in true actuality, it was really Enlil, was also in some civilizations called Lord Satan of Eden, E-D-I-N. So he actually is the original Satan, is Enlil. And they, like I said, they genetically modified us not to live that long because They did not want us to become rivals. The longer you live, the more knowledge you can, you gain, the more wisdom you obtain, the higher you can ascend. And when you realize that there's only a few of them and millions of you, and you have the same, you chew it on your pants the same way, all of a sudden there could be an uprising and a coup, and that's, you know, what they didn't want to happen.
We get texts and tweets. What do you have, Tom?
Billy, this one's from Angela in Washington, D.C. I'd like to know Billy's favorite megalithic structure and his thoughts on Edward Lead Scalman.
Of course, from Coral Castle. Questions. Go ahead, Bill.
Great question. Well, the my favorite megalithic structure is going to have to be the Great Pyramid.
Me too. I've been there. Hands down.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just too astounding, George. I've been there. I've been inside. You know, I've climbed up the King's Chamber. I've been to the Queen's Chamber. I've been inside the King's Chamber at the what they want to say is a sarcophagus, which is actually a stone box that has the same exact dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant. And when you look at it, you can tell it's not a sarcophagus. It's a holding place for something. And when you research the pyramid, you discover that it had stopped generating power from more ancient times. When the aquifer underneath it dried up, it stopped generating physiostatic electricity. So they most likely put the Ark of the Covenant inside that makeshift stone box, which you can tell was added long after the pyramid was built, in order to replace some type of technology or create some type of a flux of energy flow up to the apex of the pyramid. So that's what that is. And then Edward Lead Scalman, I've been down to the Coral Castle several times. One of the benefits of living in South Florida, I've been down there. I just was down there maybe 3 months ago, again, just going through and just looking at, you know, the amazing accomplishments that this man, this 5'6", 100-pound man, was able to do on his own using technology that I found in one of the ancient Sumerian tablets, where he's got this tripod at the top. He's got this black box. Well, there's this tripod set up in a Sumerian tablet that has a arm coming across, and it has something at the top that looks like a box. And underneath that, it has something that looks like a disc. That disc is not a disc. It's a symbol for frequency, and it's got a specific frequency etched into the stone. And I think Edward had discovered this same technology and had utilized it to levitate the blocks out there with this magnetic crank wheel that he had. And in this Sumerian tablet, or cylinder scroll, I should say, there's a Sumerian king sitting on top of a box that depicts a magnetic frequency and has two opposite poles, one to the left and one to the right. So I think that he kind of really tapped into this. He actually said that he tapped into the knowledge of the ancient Egyptians, and it's such an amazing place. I recommend anybody who can't travel, I can't get out, come to South Florida. You don't have to have a passport. You're in the United States. Just come down here. Go to the Coral Castle and look at this amazing accomplishment by Edward Lead Scalman.
Yeah, it's just an amazing story. How did you get involved in all this, Billy? How old were you, a kid?
I was a kid, man. Back in 1977, I'm aging myself there now, George.
Yeah.
I saw a UFO in my backyard. I used to live very close to the Opa-locka Airport in Miami. I used to watch the planes go over and clear the horizon point. There's nothing else to do back then. There's no TV, no cable TV, no cell phones, beepers, none of that stuff. Just watch the sky, you know? And this one particular afternoon, I went out and this glowing orb came across the horizon point, and it cleared the horizon in seconds instead of minutes. And even me as a little kid knowing, wait a minute, no, that can't be possible. Nothing can move that fast. It completely stunned me. And then it came back the way flew in, and it hovered about what I now can estimate about 200 meters above my head, and it flew back out the way it came in. So the next day I walked over to Rainbow Park Elementary School, which was only 7 houses away from where I live, and I went straight to the library. And again, no Google back then. I had to get all the Encyclopedia Britannicas on aerospace. And I literally started my research at that moment. I started looking to all different types of technology. I couldn't tell what that was. The term UFO didn't exist in my mind. Aliens and all didn't exist. All I knew was what I saw was technological, in my opinion, and I wanted to find out what it was. And that's literally when I started researching.
And you were hooked, weren't you?
I was hooked, man. That was it for me, man. It started off with private meetings with some friends and little clubhouses that we would build in the back of empty lots. Then it moved into trading cassette tapes with information on it. Then it moved into, VHS tapes, and then eventually CDs and DVDs and web blogs and forums. And now social media